For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler
and Celestia Leffler. Today on Watersheds as Commons, we present our final program in this series. In our earlier 13 programs, we have heard from dozens of people from different native cultures indigenous to the American Southwest, as well as from writers, scientists, lawyers, environmentalists, ranchers, and others who recognize that our species may now exceed the human carrying capacity of our planet, certainly within the context of global economic and political practices. On our final program, we'll listen to some of our most clear-minded thinkers who have focused on what it will take for our species to transcend the array of problems that have occurred since the advent of the Industrial Revolution over two centuries ago.
In 1890, John Wesley Powell strongly urged the United States Congress to adopt his idea for organizing the arid West, the American landscape west of the 100th meridian, as commonwealths based on watersheds that would be governed largely from within and that would refrain from importing water from without. His idea was denied, and now Westerners live within a hodgepodge of geopolitical entities, the Western states as we now know them, that compete for our most precious common resource, water. On our radio series, we have presented the case for re-examining the notion of understanding watersheds as commons, and that we and the rest of the biotic community sip from common waters in a common homeland that many would privatize at our common peril. In 1968, Dr. Garrett Hardin published his seminal essay, The Tragedy of the Commons.
I took as the example the historical instance of common pasture lands in England, which were called commons, and pointed out that those worked very well, probably for hundreds of years, and then along toward the 17th and 18th centuries, people became aware of the fact that something was wrong, that they were being overgrazed, and consequently, they were going downhill. And the basic reason was that when people have access to common lands on the basis of their need as they perceive it, and when the population grows to the point where the number of people exceeds the carrying capacity of the land, or the number of cows exceeds the carrying capacity of the pasture, then each person seeking his own self-interest will put the number of cattle he wants to on the common pasture land. And the result is that presently there are too many and the whole thing is destroyed. Now, the reason this is a tragedy is because even after each individual realizes what is happening, he is powerless to stop it because he says, well, if I don't get it, the pigs will. In other words, my neighbors who are pigs will get it. So I'll take mine before these pigs get there. Well, each neighbor reasons in the same way, and so although there's complete knowledge of what's happening, the deterioration is inevitable. So this is like a Greek tragedy where knowledge doesn't prevent the unfortunate end. Now, there is an escape from this, of course, and that is to get rid of the commons. And then you have two possibilities. Either you can turn it into private property, as was done in England, unjustly, I may say, the way it was done, but at least this will save the pasture land. Or you can turn it into public property, and then you have to appoint managers. And then you're at the mercy of the managers. If they manage well, it's fine, but if they don't, it isn't good. So there's no simple answer as to which one of the other systems will work better, private property, privatism, or socialism. Either one may work or either one may not work. But the one clear thing is that the commons cannot possibly work once the population has grown too great.
The acequia system of irrigation used by the Hispanos of northern New Mexico is a centuries-old example of cooperative use of common waters, one of many such examples worldwide. Dr. Silvia Rodriguez is an anthropologist and the author of Acequia, Water Sharing, Sanctity, and Place.
I think one of the things about the New Mexico acequias as both infrastructure and as also this cultural system, as really a social ecological system, is that they belong to a family of similar organizations all around the world that anthropologists call autonomous or semi-autonomous irrigation communities. And they operate on similar principles. And you can isolate them. I mean, you can identify them, 7 or 8, and I mentioned them in the book, drawing on a guy who worked in Peru, also using the moral economy idea. This is like common pool resource management, right? And you have these systems on every continent, and you have them in dry lands or semi-arid, and you have some in the wetlands, and of course, Bali water temples and the Subaks are the most famous, I think. They're usually involve ritual. They involve these principles, of contiguity and monitoring each other, and there's several, and I can't recite them right now. But they all resemble each other. They all have similar struggles vis-a-vis these state bureaucracies who want to impose green revolution or agribusiness practices, insecticides, pesticides, fertilizers, and regard these local autonomous, and they're autonomous in the sense that they control their own water. They're not politically autonomous because they're usually practiced by communities that are indigenous, that are subaltern, that are national minorities of one kind or another. But when these state bureaucrats come in to modernize, they see these as backward and irrational, and really that they can be improved on enormously by these sort of modern methods. And of course, the Balinese water temples that Steve Lansing has documented so extensively is a famous case. And what happened there, of course, was that it caused ecological disaster, because the primary motivation is like Green Revolution is just to increase monoculture and to have more productivity at great cost. Well, Eleanor Ostrom, who just got the Nobel Prize. Yes, I mean, her work is tremendously important and it's incredibly significant.
Dr. Eleanor Ostrom was awarded the 2009 Nobel Prize in Economic Sciences for her book, Governing the Commons. She challenges Garrett Hardin by addressing how the commons may be made to work by factoring in cooperation and mutual trust.
When we're talking about three neighbors that live around a garden plot, they can usually figure out how to handle a garden plot. Usually, not always, but usually. But we're talking about in watersheds, some of them are huge, and people don't know one another. And they're not mechanisms to enable them to get to know one another and trust one another. And the work we've been doing of recent times in terms of moving beyond this, we're not rejecting it, but moving beyond, is showing that when you model individuals as having richer preference functions, limited knowledge, but ability to learn, and they're willing to engage in cooperative action if they trust the others involved. And trust has become, in our research now, a really key link. And it hasn't been in our theory. Garrett Hardin, for example, doesn't use the word in anywhere in what he wrote. It was get the rules and have them imposed. And if people have rules imposed on them, and they don't trust the process that generated those rules and don't think they're appropriate, they'll cheat whenever they can.
Peter Warshall is a well-known ecologist who has devoted much of his time to working to sustain ecological balance within watersheds. Here he tells of a major epiphany.
Watersheds are a great way of looking at things, and of course, the problem is that water is much more complicated than a watershed. And I remember my eureka moment was in the Amargosa Basin. The Amargosa is a part of Death Valley. And when you go down the Amargosa Basin, the river actually turns around and goes into Death Valley. But if you look at the groundwater, it goes under the mountains and comes back to the headwaters. And I began to realize, okay, we can, the invisible here is always groundwater. And it's really one of the most powerful ways that human communities, especially now with pumps, have arranged their lives for human settlement. And so that complicates watershed thinking, because watershed thinking is the surface thinking. It's how runoff on the surface goes, but it doesn't take care of the invisible. And the most sacred places on the planet, especially in the northern hemisphere, have been where the invisible emerges, which is springs. There was the place where animals came together for drinking, where medicinal herbs grew best, especially mint, being a water lover, where women gathered both to wash and prepare food. The spring, where the invisible becomes visible in water, is equally important to the watershed itself. And so that's how I would go looking for the commons. I would start at the spring and see where that emergence point is. And that's why so many of the stories are emergent points. You know, in the Hopi stories, you emerge out of the earth. It's a little confusing why people would come from underground. Well, I think it's because life-giving water comes from underground at springs.
Poet and environmental philosopher Gary Snyder was part of the coterie of environmental activists who created and forwarded the practice of bioregionalism.
Bioregionalism is a kind of creative branch of the anarchist, and on the other side, a creative branch of the environmental movement that strives to re-achieve indigeneity, re-achieve aboriginality by learning about the place and what really goes on there. And bioregionalism goes beyond simple geography or biology by its cultural concern, its human concern, as well as its sort of natural history, scientific type concern. Its cultural concern is to not only know the plants and animals of a place, but to know the cultural information of how have people then lived there who knew how to do it, thus the interest in, say, American Indians, that kind of ethnicity, and then knowing what the deeper mythic, spiritual, archetypal implications of Douglas fir or coyote or blue jay might be, to know from both inside and outside what the total implications of being in place are. So it becomes a study not only of place, but a study of psyche in place. And that's what makes it so interesting. It's in a way, it seems to me, the first truly concrete step that has been taken since Kropotkin in stating how we decentralize ourselves after the 20th century.
Rena Swensel is a Tewa-speaking woman born into the Santa Clara Indian Pueblo of northern New Mexico. Here, she gives her sense of Puebloan perspective of the commons.
From a Pueblo point of view, the commons is everything. It is the context that we live in.
It includes not just humans, but includes all the other creatures, includes the sky, the clouds, the rain that comes down, and the water that flows through the land, the wind that comes through, and the way the sun moves in this particular place. I mean, looking out this window, I can see the horizon out there. And that's what the old Pueblo people always talked about, was that your community is this place that you can see that gets marked by the horizon out there. And you are, as a human person, you are but one part of it. But you are definitely a part of it. And you're going to be affected by what happens out there. The wind is going to affect you. The sun's going to affect you. But if it dries up to a point that we can't exist anymore, if we can't grow our own food in this community that we're a part of, we're not going to survive. So that the sense, the old sense of that Pueblo community was this place right here that you live in. And it includes everything that's a part of it, the ground, the kind of dirt that we live with, the kind of trees we have around us, the amount of rain that falls in this particular place, and who those other people are that are part of that. But it all goes back to caring about this place this community that we're a part of. A community is a place that we share in common. We share in common with all these other creatures. And it is about caring about it, it's nurturing, it's realizing that you're absolutely one with the place.
Daniel Kemmes was trained in political science and has served as the mayor of Missoula, Montana. He is the author of several books, including Community and the Politics of Place. Here, he addresses the idea of sustainability.
I find great hope in what I think is deep attention that is now being paid to the idea of sustainability. You know, you can think of something like sustainability as an issue of public policy, as something that we deal with kind of on the surface of things. But my sense of it is that it's much more fundamental than that, that there is a way in which our relationship to the earth itself is being redefined almost from the bottom up, and that there's a growing sense that well-being in the deepest sense, in the daily sense of what it means to live well and to live a satisfying life, can't be divorced from some sense of sustainability. That unless things can be carried on, that they're not being well done now. And Gary Snyder speaks of this so wonderfully to my mind when he talks about living now as if you were laying the base for future generations to live even better. I think there's a fundamental human instinct in that direction, and I think with a little encouragement that people can come around to see that their own lives are going to be more satisfying to the extent that they are living in such a way that life can go on and cannot decline but get better and better. You know, in a way, I think that our generation, the generation since the Second World War, has had a scare of a lot of different kinds. We had the immediate scare of the bomb and grew up under the bomb. And we had the scare that nobody else has had for a long time, that our children's lives might actually be a lesser thing than our own lives. And that's finally not acceptable to people, I don't think. They can live with it for a while, but not for long.
Gary Paul Nabhan is one of America's foremost ethnobotanists and ecological philosophers. For many years, he has nurtured the notion of food sheds as commons.
The most exciting thing happening in the West, from my perspective, is the collaborative conservation movement, where people of diverse backgrounds are saying, we share this watershed in common, we share this food shed in common, we share this larger food production system from the highlands where the sheep pasture in the summer down to the lowland irrigated pastures in valleys where they can be in the winter. And that means people collaborating beyond the narrow interests of individual private land owners to allow whole systems to function cohesively across boundaries. And to some extent, I think what we'll see in the future is what some people are calling now landscape labeling or branding of foods from a watershed or food shed that are grown sustainably along with the fiber from there, the timber from there, and that watersheds where communities come together to embrace the same stewardship principles will get a premium for their products, whether it's beef or vegetables or timber or fuel wood, because urban consumers will be willing to invest more in that land stewardship and the ecosystem services from that landscape rather than just paying for the product like beef or cucumbers or firewood alone. As long as we say, I'm only concerned about the stewardship on my piece of private property, the whole health of the watershed will still be imperiled. When we embrace returning the entire watershed to its ecological health and mobilize financial as well as knowledge resources to do that, then there will be lasting benefits from the kind of innovations that we've seen emerge over the last 20 years.
Melissa Savage is a biogeographer who has spent many years restoring damaged ecosystems in the American Southwest and beyond. Currently, she is involved in restoring river otters to their natural habitats in New Mexico. She has a clear picture of where the commons work.
Where the commons works is where people are of a mind about the fate of the environment. And only in the past few years have certain things been talked about broadly, for example, in North America, things like ecosystem services. The recognition, the broad consensus that, oh, watersheds provide something for all of us, that we can't just make private hay out of them because we need them. We need them to be intact. And, you know, I'm so impressed with the shift in consensus about what it means to have. I think global climate change has really pushed this into a new gestalt, a new way of thinking about where we are, who we are. Yeah. And, of course, the downside of commons is the overuse. And so you have to have an agreement, and this is difficult to get. We have an extremely diverse society, and we have a somewhat polarized society, as we all know, politically speaking. And so, you know, the task is really to somehow have everyone recognize what's at stake in a commons. The air, the water, the fact that global climate change is going to completely change precipitation patterns. Talk about natural processes, you know. Global climate change is just a natural process. I mean, it's actually happened many times in Earth's history. And it's happening now, but it's our doing. And of course, we have all these institutions, all these common institutions in place based on what's been going on for hundreds of years. We count on it raining X amount for our agriculture. And if that doesn't start to create a better consensus about what the commons is, obviously not North America, not the Southwest, not the region, the globe. The globe is a bioregion. What people do in one place has an incredibly strong teleconnection to other places.
Dr. Dave Gutzler is on the faculty of the Earth Sciences Department at the University of New Mexico. For many years, he has been monitoring climate change and global warming.
The models suggest that there may actually be somewhat less precip here in the winter in a warmer climate as the jet stream moves northward, in which case the smaller snowpack that's purely a result of temperature change problem would get even harder. So the trends are not looking good. So I think it's very highly likely that stream flows will diminish somewhat. Now, how quickly that happens, whether it's a matter of 10% less or 30% less, that's hard to constrain. And we need to say also that we know from history that the Southwest is extraordinarily variable with regard to precipitation and stream flow, and there's no reason to think that that is going to change.
Author and environmentalist William DeBuys has looked deeply into the probable effects of global warming and climate change in the American Southwest. He recognizes that current economics and ecological instability are deeply interrelated.
Most people through most of human history have lived in something like a steady state economy. This continuous growth way of life that we define as normal today is really an artifact of the modern era in Western Europe and exported to North America and really to the rest of the world today. But that's not where human beings evolved. That's not where we lived for all those millennia beforehand. We can do this. And that's the wisdom that we get from Native people, because they're still connected to that other reality, that longer heritage of human experience, and can draw on traditional knowledge about how that steady state world existed and what kind of values were necessary to underpin it. We are citizens of so many commons all the time. You know, in a sense, the atmosphere, which we're polluting with greenhouse gases, is a commons. Our watersheds are a commons. Qualities like silence is a commons. These days in America, you can hardly go any public place without hearing a dog on TV yammering away. Commons is what we share with each other, and somehow linked to this idea of transitioning to a steady state economy, we've got to transition to a set of values that is rooted in what we share together rooted in a sense of community, rooted in our bonds to each other, rather than in our individual existences to the degree we are so preoccupied today. And where that leads is to an emphasis on quality of life rather than on quantity of consumption. Bill McKibben has done some very interesting work and has tracked a number of interesting trends and polling systems and so forth. And he is fond of citing the fact that it seems that as Americans have accumulated more possessions, they report themselves as being less happy. More toys doesn't mean more fun. And I think as we take this consumer society to its accumulating, trash-producing reductio ad absurdum, we're finding that it's not a very satisfactory way to live. So somewhere down the line, if we're going to be successful, if we're going to get into the future more or less intact, we've got to reorient our values to the primacy of the commons, to a sense of loyalty to place, to a sense of dedication to quality of life, rather than just to the continuous consumption of more and more material.
Human consciousness is a commons. We must use that consciousness to focus on how homeland is being governed, who controls governance, and what is ethical and what is not, and where does human legislation violate natural law. To that extent, we must become involved in protecting home watershed from outside interests whose main concerns are economic gain, regardless of harm to homeland. When corporate economics and government are so intertwined that homeland is jeopardized, we as fellow humans must respond accordingly and consciously. Primary governance must come from those most intimately connected to the region being governed, rather than from distant centers of power. The primary principles of governance must emerge from understanding natural law and being guided by conscience as well as consciousness, rather than variations on economic themes based on turning habitat into money. Thinking like a watershed is a metaphor for living in balance with nature.
On this final program of Watersheds as Commons, we've heard the voices of Garrett Hardin, Sylvia Rodriguez, Eleanor Ostrom, Peter Warshaw, Gary Snyder, Rena Swensel, Daniel Kemis, Gary Paul Nabhan, Melissa Savage, Dave Gutzler, and William DeBuis. Theme music was performed by Carl Bernstein. Production of Watersheds as Commons is funded by the Christensen Fund and the New Mexico Humanities Council, and is produced in the studios of the Loeffler Oral History Archive. For free access to other Lore of the Land programming, including our earlier radio series, Moving Waters, the Colorado River and the West, please visit our website at www.loreoftheland.org. For the Lore of the Land, this is Celestia Loeffler
and Jack Loeffler. Thank you for listening.